All right, Isaiah 17. And we're going to be looking at the first 11 verses tonight. The headings in a lot of our Bibles will mention the oracle concerning Damascus or something of that nature. But really only it's sort of a combined situation here, and I'll explain that. But only really the first three verses deal with Damascus, with Syria. If we were to go back to chapter 7 and look at the political situation that was going on at the time, remember, you get tired of hearing this, Assyria is the rising power. Assyria is going to be coming down from the north. Remember, you don't cut across the desert. And Assyria is going to be coming down through the north, because if you go due east, it's just desert, and there's no water or anything. And so you have to go up and over the Fertile Crescent. And how are you going to stop this gigantic empire with their army of tens, if not hundreds of thousands of soldiers? How are you going to stop these folks when you've got this little kingdom here and this little kingdom here and this little one over here and this little one over here? What do you do? Well, you form an alliance. And in previous generations, remember Ahab, the guy that Elijah had to deal with? Ahab had actually formed an alliance with some of the kings around him. And last time the Assyrians had a big advance, several generations before, they had been able to stop them. It had worked before. And so the Assyrian Empire never got down into that region of what is now Syria, Israel, Jordan, that area, because they'd been stopped further to the north. Well, there's an attempt to do the same thing. Now, you got two problems right now with that. Number one is Assyria is stronger than it was several generations before, and the kingdoms that are working on forming an alliance are weaker than they were several generations before. They are smaller, they are weaker, and therefore there's an effort to put together this alliance. And the Syrians there in Damascus, the Arameans of Damascus, same city as Damascus today, has formed an alliance with the northern kingdom of Israel, capital of Samaria. This is before there were Samaritans, but this is, same city. And those two have gotten together, and they are trying to force Judea, with its capital at Jerusalem, to join the alliance. And the folks there in Judea are thinking, there's no way on earth this alliance is going to work, and so we're not going to, get on Assyria's bad side, because we're already in their crosshairs. And we're not going to be part of this. We'll just, when they show up, we'll pay them some tribute and let them leave us alone. And so the Syrians of Damascus and the Israelites with their capital in Samaria had looked at joining forces and attacking Judea to force them into the alliance, which of course didn't end up working. We saw that earlier in the book of Isaiah. So what is going to happen to this alliance? This prophecy is in regard to that alliance of Israel and Damascus. And so it says there in verse 1, the burden of Damascus, the word burden there deals with something that is heavy news, is the idea there. You see this that word fairly often dealing with prophecies of judgment and so on, the burden. And so it's something heavily borne. It's bad news coming down. And so the burden of Damascus, behold, Damascus is taken away from being a city. It shall be a ruinous heap. When the Assyrians are done, there's not going to be much left. You say, well, isn't Damascus there today? Yes, it is. Damascus vies with Jericho as being the oldest continually inhabited place in the world. Archaeological digs go down, a long, 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 long way. What do those two places have in common? Why would that be because what you had is both those places have been destroyed numbers of times, and if they keep rebuilding a city there. Why do you keep rebuilding a city at the same place if every, anywhere from 50 to 300-400 years it gets destroyed? Why do you keep rebuilding? What's that?
Location,
location, location, location. It's a phenomenal site. If you look at a map of the Middle East, I'm not going to do my famous map. This is not a map. Okay, we're in the other classroom, that's right. That's just a screen. if you look at a map of the Middle East, you'll notice that you got this little green strip along the coast there. And the further north you go, the greener it gets. Lebanon gets a fair amount of rain. There's woods and olive groves and stuff like that in Lebanon. And then Lebanon is unique in that it has a tree on their national flag today. You've got a big evergreen tree in the middle of it, which is a cedar of Lebanon. Very good. And those are, you go up, as you go inland from Lebanon, Lebanon was the ancient empire of the Phoenicians. Same piece of ground. Tyre and Sidon are in what is now Lebanon. And the reason historically, I mentioned that out of the surrounding nations around Israel, Judah, the only one that they never had major conflict with were the Phoenicians. And the reason was they were trade partners. Both of them needed each other. The Phoenicians had their sailing ships, and they went all over the place, and they brought in all kinds of goodies from Greece and from Turkey and even as far away as Rome and Spain. And they brought all this stuff, and they shuffled it all over and sold it. They were the Walmart of the ancient world. Anything you wanted, they got it. Fred Meyer, you'll find it from the Phoenicians. If you wanted some oddball thing, they were the ones that could get it. And what did Judea and Israel have to offer? Food. All right. If you're spending all your time traveling the world, you have to eat. Somebody's gotta be home tending the fields and stuff. And so what they did is they were trade partners. Israel would provide the Phoenicians with food, and the Phoenicians would provide the Israelites with timber from the mountains of Lebanon. Remember, we saw this with Solomon's temple and so on, and a number of other things. So there was an exchange going back and forth there. And if you go up and over those mountains where all the cedars and the fir trees and all these other things grew, you come down the other side, and it's kind of like eastern Washington. You're going up and over the Cascades. It's green on one side. You come down the other side, and it's sagebrush. You have a very similar situation when you're crossing the Lebanon Mountains. You come down the other side, but that's where Damascus is. Now, if you go on the east side of the Cascades, there are places where it's green. Where is it green? By water. Well, where are you going to get the water out in the desert? Some places. Okay, where there's a river coming off the mountains. Because you get the rain and the snow in the mountains, as it melts, it comes down. Some on the east side, some on the west side. All right, Wenatchee has a big river because it's coming off of the Cascades. And you have two rivers that come off of those mountains that flow right next to each other. And that's where Damascus is. So you've got an ideal situation where you have access to water, and you've got relatively fertile soil. It's a good look, and that's also where the caravan route was. It's a great, great location. Which is why, for thousands of years, there has been a city on that location. So, it's the same place. It's going to be wiped out here. It's going to be a ruinous heap by the time the Assyrians are done with the Syrians. By the way, somebody asked me this last week. No connection at all between Syria and Assyria. Assyria is derived from one of their first capitals, which is Asher. Excuse me, two S's there. Asher. And one R. Get it straight. Sometimes I have dyslexia a little. This is where you get Assyria. So they're different places, different cultures, and so forth. So when the Assyrians are done with the Syrians, or the Aramaeans, the city is going to be a ruinous heap. There's not going to be anything left. They're going to carry the people away captive. And that'll be the end of it. Then we jump down to verse 2. The cities of Arior, or Aroer, are forsaken. They shall be for flocks and which shall lie down, and none shall make them afraid. This word, the name of this place, occurs a handful of times in the scripture. Okay, where is this place? When it talks about the cities of, that term is used over 100 times in your Old Testament. The cities of blank, put in the blank. And you are talking about either the cities that make up a kingdom, or, as in this case, the cities that make up a region. Say unto the cities of Judah, behold your God, which you're going to see later on in the book of Isaiah, which is part of Handel's Messiah. Okay. So You think under the cities of Judah, Bethlehem is one of the cities of Judah. All right. In this area, you have a region called Aroer. And, okay, I'm going to have to do my math. All right, let's do this. By the way, Damascus is right over there. You have Dan, because you got a little, three rivers here, and then another little lake up here called Lake Hula, as in, okay? And, thought you'd appreciate that. And then you have the mountains here that we were talking about before. And then two rivers that come off of these and go past out here and then die in the desert. All right, Jerusalem here. Now, when we did this last week, okay, we're going to do our little kingdoms down here. This one is with an E,
Edom.
Okay, north of Edom on the east side of the Dead Sea is
Moab.
And then over here, over a little bit, over here is Ammon. All right. What about this piece of ground here? What about this piece of ground? Whose turf is this? It's Israel on both sides. When Moses brought the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt, they wandered around down here in the Sinai, and then they came up over here, and the Edomites said, "You can't come through our territory." And so they skirted the territory, and they ended up going through some really tough area. And this is where the snakes were biting them, and they made the metal snake on a pole. And then you had Balak, who hired Balaam, and he was and Balak was from Moab, and God wouldn't let Balaam curse the Israelites. And so they skirted Moab because God had told Moses, told the children of Israel, these three nations, because their ancestry. Because these two are the children of Lot, and this one is Israel's brother. As far as Esau, this is the descendants of Esau. These are the descendants of Lot. And so God said, I've given those pieces of territory to these people. So they come up to here, and this was an Amorite kingdom. An Amorite kingdom. And Israel sent messengers up through there saying, hey, we just need to head up over here so we can cross the river. Will you let us in? And these folks here just threatened them. These guys over here showed up and mobilized and attacked Israel. And Israel beat them. And then the folks that lived up in this region here, they mobilized and came in and attacked. This area here was originally called Bashan. Okay, this whole area here is Gilead. And this was inhabited by Israelites. Down here in the bottom, I'm doing this because as you read through your Old Testament, you're going to see references to this stuff. And this is to help you figure it out. Down here in the bottom is where the tribe of Reuben settled. A little further to the north over here, east of Galilee, is where the tribe of Gad settled. And then up here in the north is where one half of the tribe of Manasseh settled. All right? When you read about the half tribe of Manasseh, it doesn't mean that Manasseh is a half a tribe. It means that half of the tribe of Manasseh settled here because the other half settled in this area over here. So they were split. This area here, because they were separated from the rest of Israel by the Jordan and so on, often had more problems with idolatry and so on. But also, the Jordan, remember, there's no bridges. So this is a line of defense. Invading armies have either got to go and over in this area, which is rough ground, or they've got to come over here and cross. This is the Jordan at this time was a pretty good defense. So when you have the armies of Assyria coming in, they're going to hit Damascus. Damascus first, and then they're going to head down on the east side of Jordan, and they're going to hit this area of Gilead, and they're going to hit Gad. Aroer is a section here, east of Galilee. It's the largest town in that area, and basically this is Isaiah saying that Gad is going to be next in the crosshairs, that region, as the Assyrians come down. They shall be forsaken. People are gonna abandon their cities. They're gonna be refugees. They're gonna gather up all they can get and go. And they're gonna head south. Just like we saw with the Moabites that we looked at last week and the week before. They're gonna head south to avoid the oncoming armies. And so they're gonna abandon their cities and they're gonna head south. They're gonna head down into Reuben, tell them we're gonna try to cross over here into Israel and into Judea. And there's gonna be nothing left. It's kind of interesting. If you don't have people in an area, and it says, it shall be a place for flocks, which shall lie down and none shall make them afraid. Because even the thieves are taking off. You know, you think about people abandoning someplace, they're taking all that's valuable with them. And then if you've got these looters behind, who are gonna go through and they're gonna go into all the houses, and what are they gonna do? Steal the gutters, get that aluminum, take the plumbing. Even the looters are having to face the same thing. So the looters are taking off too because the Assyrians are coming. Like I said, this is like a locust plague that comes through. There's a lot more of the Assyrians than there are people that even live in that area. The Assyrian army is bigger than the number of people that live here. So it's like locusts coming through and they take everything. Exactly. So even the looters, even the ne'er-do-wells are taking off as well. And so there's nothing left. And so you have a depopulated area, and so the livestock are like, and they're just enjoying the fact that they're being left alone. They're grazing on the grass. They're getting into the gardens. They're having their thing because there's nobody left. Everybody's gone. And it says in verse 3, we deal with a generic term, and you have to sort of figure out what it is. The fortress also shall cease from Ephraim. And the kingdom from Damascus. Now remember, in Hebrew poetry, you have parallelism. You see this in Proverbs. Proverbs is a great example. You have parallelism. It's either antithetical or, what's the word I'm looking for? Where it's the same. You know what I'm talking about. But anyway, it's not based on rhyme, it's based on what you're talking about. And so you can use that principle. Here in context, we are dealing with it with a like parallel. So he says, the fortress shall cease from Ephraim and the kingdom from Damascus. Ephraim, okay, we're going to draw another line over here. I'm going to clear this out a little bit because it gets too busy. And we don't need these guys right now either. All right. So this kidney bean down here is the Dead Sea. All right. This dot here is Jerusalem. And about 40 miles north of Jerusalem is the city of Samaria, which at this time was the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel. Now, after the reign of Solomon, Solomon had a zillion and a half kids because he had, 600 wives and 300 porcupines? Prickly situation. His son Rehoboam was not a particularly bright fellow. He wasn't the sharpest tool in the drawer. And so he does not take counsel from his father's counselors. Instead, he talks to the young, inexperienced morons that grew up with him. And he alienates everybody to the north, and so the kingdom ends up being divided. And the line was basically curved like that. And so to the south, you have Judah, and to the north, you have what was called Israel. Capital of Jerusalem, capital of Samaria at this time. Dominant tribe. You have the 10 tribes. The 10 supposedly lost tribes. And by the way, this is when they get lost, supposedly. You have Asher, Naphtali, Issachar. Those unpronounceable ones. And they're up here in this region. Dan is up here. You get further south and you have bigger blocks of territory. You get more rainfall up here. It's very fertile up in this area. You could have more people and less ground. You get further south, you have bigger territory. And early on, the dominant tribe in the north was Ephraim. For a number of reasons. They had a big population. They also were the tribe that had the territory, which was Samaria. And so when you're reading through your Old Testament, especially in the prophetic books, you will see the word Ephraim used as a synonym for the whole kingdom. All right. I was born in upstate New York. When somebody mentions New York, you don't think of the state, you think of the city. And those of us who were living in the farm country and enjoying the woods in the far north think, hey, what's the matter with this? You know, this is New York, not that dirty, money-sucking place down at the bottom of the hill there. We just cut that off north of Yonkers and send it adrift. kind of like we think of, you know, the west part of King County. Ephraim is synonymous with Israel. So when we read this, at least as far as our text is here, and it's mentioned that way in a number of places. So the fortress shall cease from, we can use the word Israel instead of Ephraim because it conveys the same idea. What was the fortress of Ephraim? Now they had a number of fortified cities and so on here. But the main fortress was the capital. They made it the capital because it was a very, very, very defensible place. Same reason David made Jerusalem his capital. It's a defensible place. Samaria was in on a plain, a relatively flat area. For a number of miles around, it was flat. Except there was a great big huge hill in the middle of it. Now, originally that wasn't even a town. That was somebody's threshing floor. Remember the breezes come through and so on? And somebody bought it and turned it into built a city there. Omri, who was Ahab's dad, bought it and turned it into a city. The owner of the hill was a guy named Shemer, and Omri honored him by naming his city Shemaria. You get the idea. All right. But it was a great defensive place. The hill goes up a couple of hundred feet, and it's out in the middle of a plain. It's a great, great place for defenses. You can see an invading army come quite a while before they actually arrive. And then when they come, they're all way down and your city's way up. It's a great, great situation. But it says here that the fortress, which is almost certainly Samaria, is going to cease. The Assyrians laid siege to Samaria for 3 years. It took that long. But they are a cussed bunch of folks, and they were determined to stick it out, and they made it happen. And they took Samaria. And they slaughtered a great many of the inhabitants, and they carried the rest of them off and planted them way over here where Lucy and Schroeder are. And so the fortress ceased from Ephraim. Now, it's going to be a long time, but Samaria will eventually be rebuilt. And for those of you who are here this morning, that's where the revival took place under Philip when we get to Acts chapter 8. All right, same place, but totally different setting and actually very different people than were there at this time. So the fortress shall cease. Samaria, the capital city of Israel, is going to be taken in spite of its great location, in spite of its defenses, and despite the fact that at the time this was written, they are threatening Judea, they are threatening Jerusalem, Israel is. It won't be too much longer before that northern kingdom of Israel is, they're gone. They are not a kingdom anymore. They are nothing to be concerned about. And what about Damascus? And Damascus, the kingdom shall cease from Damascus. So these two nations, Syria here, Israel here, both those nations are going to be gone. They will cease to exist as nations. These two areas were incorporated into the Assyrian Empire. They weren't just tributary where they are allowed to maintain some measure of autonomy, but they have to pay a certain amount of tribute every year. Or they were a defensive buffer state to protect the Assyrians from Egypt, which is down over here in this region. No, they were just incorporated. They were annexed by the Assyrian Empire. They ceased to be nations. And so the Assyrians are coming. It doesn't matter what alliance is there. It doesn't matter what preparations they're making. It doesn't matter how many weapons that they can stockpile or how many mercenaries they can hire to help fight the war. It's not going to happen. Both of these nations are going to cease to exist as a nation. Now remember, Very, very, very seldom do you have in history a people totally disappear. You may have a nation disappear. You may have cultures and languages disappear, but there's always a few of the people that survive, and they end up getting integrated into another culture and so on. And so the 10 lost tribes aren't lost. Their identity perhaps has been lost somewhere along the way. We do know that in the New Testament era, when in the book of Luke, when Joseph and Mary bring the baby Jesus to the temple for his dedication, you have two old timers that meet them in the temple. You have, tell me who they are. You have Anna, and then who's the fella? Okay. Simeon. Okay. She, it mentions just in passing, was from the tribe of Asher. Just mentioned in passing. Asher's one of these 12 lost tribes. How can they be lost if you have somebody there in Jerusalem in the New Testament era, 700 and some odd years after this, who knows their tribal connection? So they're not gone. They're smaller than the tribe of Judah. There's less of them. But they're still there. And they have to be there because in Revelation you have 12,000 from each tribe that are the 144,000. So they have to exist, they have to be there, and there has to be that many of them. And there has at that time, and also there has to be enough of them so that when we get to the millennium, each tribe has their allotment in the land of promise. There has to be enough of them so that they can fill out their allotment. All right, so they're not extinct. But they don't know who they are. They don't know who they are. God knows. That's all that matters. Because when the Lord returns, or even when you have the 144,000, they might not necessarily know what their tribal connection is, but God does. And so you've got 144,000 that are preaching the word, and lo and behold, God knows who they are. We don't have to know. God just says that this is what their connection is. Even when they have their ministry during the tribulation, their identity is not necessarily known. Might be, but it doesn't have to be in order to fulfill that promise. And you'd be surprised how some of these mysteries as far as tribal alliances and stuff like that, or tribal connections, some of that stuff is known. Some of it is. I mentioned before that they know who the Levites are, for the most part. They know who the priests are. This is today. They know who the priests are. So that if they had a temple, they know who they've already got their base of workers that are, according to the law of Moses, qualified, and they've got their priests. They can offer the sacrifices by qualification because they still know who they are. Mentioned that if you're familiar, this is not an uncommon name. Usually a Jew, almost always a Jewish name. Cohen. Cohen is a Hebrew word meaning priest. Easy way to keep track of it. Hey, buddy, your last name is Priest. You know what that means you are? You're a priest. Okay, by ancestry. I'm going to put somebody's name up here. My kids always get a kick out of this. This is on his tombstone. Google it. It's on his tombstone. It mentions that this guy is a Levite. His name? Curly Howard, of the Three Stooges, is a Levite. Says so on his tombstone. They know. They know. That'll let you know what I do with my spare time. All right. There's reasons we don't videotape this. Oh, dear. Okay. Verse 4. In that day it shall come to pass that the glory of Jacob shall be made thin, and the fatness of his flesh shall wax lean. I have, and many of you have too, known people that were great big people. Not necessarily this, but built like my kid. All right? And they get a disease. whether it be cancer or something else. And you might not have seen them in a long time. You remember them in their prime. And then you see them as the disease takes its toll on their body, and you see them again, and you just, you have to be careful that you don't do this when you see them. Because you're just blown away at how they've wasted away to nothing. You formerly remember these great big huge strapping people, and then the next time you see them, these little, you can't even believe it's the same person. And they open their mouth. I remember my grandmother, my dad's mom, was a plump woman. And she had a heart attack in 76, I think it was 75 or 76. And so she had to watch her diet and so on after that. It was a fairly serious heart attack. Back in those days, it was unusual that she'd survived it. And she lost a fair amount of weight. And then she went up to live with my Aunt Nancy in Quebec. And my grandmother had this clear bell-like voice. She used to sing on the radio, Christian radio, back in the 40s and stuff when it was live. She'd show up and had the kids over here, and she'd be singing on the radio. And beautiful, clear voice, very distinctive. And I remember going to see her in the hospital 3 days before she died. And here is my grandmother, who I'm used to seeing, you know, grandma, and just this little almost skeletal figure lying in the bed. And she looked up and smiled at me, and there was the voice. The voice was the same. And the bright blue eyes were the same. But the body was gone. Just this little emaciated body. I don't know if she weighed 110 pounds at the time. And that's the description given here. That you're going to have somebody that was at one point big and strong and stout, and they have now wasted away to nothing. In that day it shall come to pass the glory of Jacob shall be made thin, and the fatness of his flesh shall wax lean. What was once great is now very little. And it shall be as when the, and then he uses three illustrations. One of them is, the first one is the wasting away of the fat man. And by the way, that's going to be their glory. It's probably also going to be the starvation of the remnant, or at least of some of the people during the siege, because you end up doing cannibalism and all these other nasty things. Verse 5, it shall be as when the harvestman gathereth the crop and reapeth the ears with his arm. It shall be as he that gathereth ears of grain in the valley of Rephaim. Okay, here you've got a broad field of wheat or barley, and these days, you know, they just run a threshing machine through there and you just have the stubble left. In those days, the outcome is still the same, but you had a sickle, and you would cut the grain, and you would gather the grain until you had a huge armful, and then you'd pass it to one of the ladies who was behind you, and they would tie them into sheaves and stand them up. So the ladies would be following the men. The men are cutting the stuff, and then when they had a big enough armful, they'd pass it to somebody. But when you're all done, when all the stuff is cut, and then they haul it away, they don't just leave it sitting out there in the field. They take it away, and they take it up to the threshing floor where they thresh it and process it, and then you store the grain, and you burn the chaff. And what about the field? What does the field look like when you're done? Yeah, the ground is there's nothing there. It's just bristles sticking out of the ground. And if they're harvesting it like this by hand, it's sort of uneven and so on. But there's nothing there. It's like when you first cut hay. You know, after when the rains come, and then you get a second cutting stuff after it grows up. But when you first do that, boy, it's just prickly, nothing here. And that's what he's describing. It's as if the field's been gleaned, it's already been harvested, there's nothing left. That means that after the Assyrians come, it's all gone. There's nothing left. You got a piece of ground and there's nothing there. Verse 6, yet gleaning grapes shall be left in it, as the shaking or the beating of an olive tree. They would have a long pole, and they would have a bunch of children, or the ladies and so on. And you would have a man up there, and he'd have a big pole, 8, 10, 12 feet long. And he would, when the olives were ripe, he'd bang the branches. And all the olives would come dropping down. And everybody would pick them up and put them into containers. And then they'd take them over to the wine press, or the olive press. By the way, that's what the word Gethsemane means, is olive press, by the way. And then they'd press their olive oil. But they would beat the tree. Now, when they're done beating the tree, if you stand back and you look carefully, did he get them all? There's a few left. A few that weren't quite ripe yet, or that, you know, just tenaciously hanging on. That's what he's talking about. When, after the Assyrians come through, you're just going to have those few left. You're not going to have what used to be just filled with fruit, is as if it's already been harvested, and all you've got left is the few little hangers-on that weren't quite ready. Or that's all that's left. The gleanings, at best, are what's left. He says two or three berries on the top of the uppermost bough, four or five in the outmost fruitful branches. So that's all that's left. What used to be filled. Just a few, just a handful here and there when the Assyrians are done. What of the remnant? Because there's always a remnant. Remember, you have to have, and God's got to fulfill his promise, so there has to be some people to work with. So verse 7, at that day shall a man look to his maker, not his idols, but his real maker. And his eyes shall have respect to the Holy One of Israel. That's a key term, by the way, in Isaiah. You see that term all the time, the Holy One of Israel. He shall not look to the altars and to the works of his hands, the gods that he has made for himself. Neither shall he respect that which his fingers have made, either the groves or the images, the things regarding their idolatrous worship. He's not going to turn to his idols. They did a whole lot of good for him when the Assyrians came, praying to their idols and so on, and the Assyrians still came. Didn't deliver him. And so afterward, they will turn to the Lord. He's not going to regard his false gods. But here's the condition of the land, verses 9 through 11. And this will tie into their idolatry as well. In that day shall his strong cities be as a forsaken bough, and an outermost branch, dealing with the imagery that he'd used before, which they left because of the children of Israel and because of their desolation. The idea of the outermost branch can also be understood. Remember Hebrew, a lot of his context. Remember, you don't have vowels. They've added this stuff, but as this was originally written, there's no vowels. And so you have the idea of, I'm not going to draw the picture, I'll describe it. We have a huge one of these over here, Mount Rainier. If you go up a mountainside, the slopes are covered with vegetation. Even in a place that's real dry, the slopes, especially on the east and on the north, will be covered with vegetation. Even in a place where you might get 8-10 inches of rain, they have vegetation on the slopes. Why? Why is there water? If it only gets 8 or 10 inches of rain, and the surrounding areas get just as much rain, but only on the slopes of the mountains you have vegetation. Why? It runs down. And so you get more vegetation that way, especially in the ravines and stuff, that you end up with more water accumulating there so you can grow the vegetation. What about the top? What's that?
Snow.
Okay, but we're not talking about real high. Let's say we're talking about just a hill that's maybe a couple thousand feet high.
Wax.
Do you have vegetation on the top? Why? There's no runoff.
The water's all gone.
Yeah, so the top is barren. Plus, the climate up there is harsher. You got the wind and all this other stuff. And so what he's saying here is that when the Assyrians are done, it's going to be like the top of the hill. Not the slopes, but it's going to be like the barren top of the hill. There's just nothing there. There's rocks. Okay. In that day, and here's where his idolatry ties in. Remember that the idolatry of this region was fertility cults. And it was tied to the change of the seasons. You would have, of course, wet and dry for the most part, like it is here. You would have the rains come in the winter and everything greens up. And then you would have all the flowers and the fruit produced and everything. And this is the fertility. And then summer sets on and everything dies. And it dies until the rains come again. And then the whole thing starts over again. This was the basis of their religion. It's a fertility cult. And this is why they had groves of trees, because this was symbolic of their fertility cult. So, verse 10, because thou hast forgotten the God of thy salvation, the true God, and hast not been mindful of the rock of thy strength, therefore shalt thou plant pleasant plants. This is not a gardener, this is for worship. And shalt set it with strange slips. What's a slip? Yeah, you're setting your cutting, your rooted cuttings and so on, those are your slips. They've been doing that kind of thing for a long time. And they're setting out their garden. And in that day, thou shalt make thy plant to grow. You're going to water it. You're going to fertilize it. You're going to do all that's necessary. And in the morning, shalt thou make thy seed to flourish. The flowers are going to come and everything, but the harvest shall be a heap, not a heap of grain. A heap in the day of grief is just going to be, it'll be destroyed. So these people have done their idolatry, they've planted their groves, they've done all that is necessary for their fertility cult, and they're hoping that the gods of the fertility cult, the Baals and so on, will deliver them from the Assyrians, and when it's all done, it's a ruinous heap. It did them no good. The emptiness, the vanity of their false worship. And but the harvest shall be a heap in the day of grief and of desperate sorrow. So the idea of the vanity of the idolatrous worship. So this is where what Israel became. Israel had their altars at Bethel, which is right here on the border of Judah, and then way up here in the north, the city of Dan, they had an altar there. And they had the exact same, this is the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which they never departed from. This is one of the reasons why there were no good kings in the northern kingdom of Israel. They maintained this worship. What kind of worship did they have at Bethel and at Dan? These two extremes. What was going on there? They did the same thing that happened in Exodus 32. They had a golden calf, and they said, these be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. They worshipped in name the true God, but it was idolatry. And they went through the motions. They observed the Sabbath. They observed the dietary restrictions. They went through all the motions. That was the official religion. But Baal worship permeated the culture as well. They did both. They celebrated Christmas. And they went to the Christmas parties and got drunk and had orgies. You know, that kind of thing. All right. So it was a synthesis of these two things. It was corrupt. It was wicked. It was debauched. And this was the culture in the Northern Kingdom for its duration. But after it's all said and done, what we have there is what we see there in verses 7 and 8. They will return to the Lord. Now, did they turn? Are we looking at something prophetic? Because the Bible says they will. When the Lord returns, you're going to have all 12 tribes in their allotments serving the Lord. In that day, all Israel shall be saved. We see in Genesis chapter, or in Romans 11. So, is it prophetic? Could be. Was there a turning away from their idolatry? Yes. Because after all these happened, after the sacking of Samaria, and then 100 some odd years later, the sacking and destruction of Jerusalem, after that, idolatry was never a problem for the Jewish people. Now, It's a religion of ritual and works today. They're not truly worshiping God. They're maintaining an outward appearance, but they never lapsed back into their idolatry. And even during the Roman times and the Greek times and so on, they died rather than turn back to idolatry, even when it was being forced upon them. They never, ever went back. So this was, these things, the Assyrians and then later on the Babylonians were the cure. Very hard lesson to learn, but it was the cure to deliver them from their idolatry. Any questions on what we looked at here? Yes?
As 40 miles above Jerusalem, the city's being sacked for 3 years, what are the people in Jerusalem doing? Are they hunkering down?
They're biting their nails. But here's the point. These two were being destroyed because they would not yield. They would not yield. Now, does this mean that Judea is yielding? Yes and no. Oh, the Assyrians are coming. Let's send them a present. We'll send them a lot of money. And very often, the Assyrians would say, okay, that's enough, because it'll cost us this much time and effort and so on to go down there and lay siege and attack this. And if they're just going to give us the money instead of going over here, then we'll come over here and we'll sack Moab and Edom and leave these guys alone because they already gave us a bunch of money. Because we don't need this little piece of territory here. If they're willing to pay us off, we'll take this over here because these guys are resisting and not willing to give us the money. So we'll come over here and attack these guys. If these guys are going to give us the money, then we'll leave them alone. They might actually buy it, or it might not be money that you're paying them off with supplies. You know, there's ways to satiate the savage beast. Now, and they were doing that. That's how Judah and Jerusalem survived at this point. Hezekiah comes to the throne. And by the way, there's a back off, and then they're going to come back in a couple of years later, because he's got other nations he's going to attack and so on. Then he'll be back. When he comes back, you've got Hezekiah on the throne, and Hezekiah says, I'm not going to pay you guys anything. And we're going to see that in Isaiah, and that's where Jerusalem is laid siege. And God will deliver Jerusalem. That's the remarkable thing that we're going to see here in a few chapters. But at this point, you have a different king, and he's like, I'm going to do anything that the Assyrians want, because if I don't, they're going to come in here and wipe us out. If they can do that to Damascus, and they can do that to Samaria, and Samaria is a better defensive place than Jerusalem. If they can do that to those places, then we're sitting ducks here, so we're going to do everything we can to survive, even if it impoverishes us, it's better than dying. So they're biting their nails. And all these peoples are, because they know that this is coming. It's kind of like 1939, and you live in Belgium. That the Nazis are going to be coming into France, and you're in between the two. And last time this happened, they came through Belgium. And guess what? They're going to do it again. And it's just a matter of time. You're waiting for them to arrive. You know it's going to happen. It's just a matter of when. So it's nail-biting time. Okay. Anything else? All right. Our Heavenly Father, Lord, these things came upon these people because they despised you. They were more interested in the political expediency of pursuing their idolatry than in yielding to what your word had to say. And Father, they paid a horrible price as a result. Father, we're thankful for the grace of God. We're thankful for salvation. But Father, we sometimes individually receive a great deal of chastisement to get our attention if we live a life of rebellion. And Father, I pray that we'd submit ourselves to you. Father, it's not so much a judgment, but it's a chastisement to bring us back to where we're supposed to be. And Father, I pray that we would live a life that would honor and glorify the Savior instead of pursuing a life that honors and glorifies ourselves. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.